Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Criminal Law and Corporations, Securities, and Antitrust Practice Groups, was recorded on June 21, 2012, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group telephone conference call on the Responsible Corporate Officer Doctrine. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. Today we have two guest speakers, Mr. Gerald Masudi and Mr. Rick Bloomberg. Each will speak for some 10 minutes, after which we'll have some discussion and then questions from the audience. Mr. Rick Bloomberg, is the Deputy Chief Counsel for Litigation at the Office of Chief Counsel of the FDA. He joined FDA's General Counsel's Office in 1970 and has played a substantial role in litigating many important trial and appeal cases on the agency's behalf. Mr. Gerald Masudi is a partner in Covington & Burling's Washington, D.C. office, where he is co-chair of the Food and Drug Practice Group. Mr. Masudi most recently served as chief counsel of the FDA, where he was responsible for, among other things, supervising FDA's involvement in civil and criminal litigation and investigations. And with that, Mr. Bloomberg, please go right ahead with your opening remarks.
All right, thank you. And when Jerry was here, he's also responsible for supervising me. I assume that most people know, but it's worth saying anyhow, almost always the government is required to prove some intent in a criminal case that the defendant acted knowingly or willfully. The Food and Drug Act is a strict liability statute. The government is not required to prove intent, knowledge of the violations. We're not even required to prove negligence. The government's also not required to prove that the defendant participated in the wrongful conduct. The key language in Park, the Supreme Court case in 1975, says the act imposes not only a positive duty to seek out and remedy violations when they occur, but also and primarily a duty to implement measures that will ensure that violations will not occur. That's the most important sentence in Park, and if you had to pick one word in Park, in my view, that's the most important, that word is duty. And the primary duty is to prevent violations from occurring in the first place. The duty is non-delegable. In Smith v. California, a Supreme Court case in 1960, it was really a pornography case, not a food and drug case, but the court commented there, the public interest in the purity of its food is so great as to warrant the imposition of the highest standard of care, an absolute standard which will not hear a plea as to the amount of care used. Park is really, it's a culture shift, not only for, I think, the industry and industry lawyers, but frankly, it's also a culture shift from many government lawyers. Most of the cases that FDA brings and the government brings is really primarily to punish individuals and secondarily to achieve general deterrence. FDA enforcement, as envisioned in Park and Dodderwijk, is a different rationale. The court said in Dodderwijk, penalties serve as the effective means of regulation. So it focuses more on general deterrence, in my view, rather than specific deterrence. Some refer to the doctrine, including the title of this webinar, as the Responsible Corporate Officer Doctrine. I think that's a misnomer. The act actually does not apply just to corporate executives, but it applies to, quote, all who have a responsible share in the furtherance of the illegal transaction, and that's from the Dodderwijk case. So we can reach low-level people, mid-level people, and high-level people if they participated in the violation in some way or have it or furthered it. Let me talk a little bit about the facts of the Park case so you can get some idea of the context of the language and its scope. John Park was CEO of Acme Markets, which was a major U.S. grocery chain, in 1975. Mr. Park's headquarters were in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, and Acme Markets had 36,000 employees, 874 retail outlets around the country. In 1970, FDA sent Mr. Park a warning letter regarding insanitary conditions at a Philadelphia warehouse. Then in 1971, FDA inspected an Acme distribution center in Baltimore, and it found similar insanitary conditions. In 1972, FDA sent Park a letter describing the Baltimore inspection results. And I should also add, after the Philadelphia inspection, they sent Park a warning letter describing the violations in Philadelphia. Then in 1972, FDA reinspected the Baltimore facility. It found improvement, but still troubling conditions. The government filed a 5-count misdemeanor indictment. It's worth noting, I think, that 4 of the counts were for observations made during the 1971 Baltimore inspection, about which John R. Park had no notice. The company pled guilty before trial. Park went to trial solely on the individual responsibility issue, and the trial was in Baltimore, Maryland. The evidence of rodent infestation was not contested, and in the government's case, we had a legal officer testify that Park functioned by delegating normal operating duties but retained ultimate responsibility for broad principles with respect to operating the company. Park was the only defense witness, and he testified unsuccessfully, ultimately, that he operated by delegation. He testified that he didn't, quote, believe there was anything he could have done more constructively than what he had, than what was being done. And what he did was he went to the manager for the regional manager for the Baltimore warehouse, and he said, fix it. And the Baltimore warehouse manager, I think his name was, I don't remember what his name was. It might have been Mahoney. It's in the decision. He said, I'm fixing it, and don't worry about it. I'll reply to FDA. Everything's taken care of. Obviously, it wasn't taken care of. So the Rule 29 motion was denied. And the district court instructed the jury, the individual is or could be liable even if he did not consciously do wrong. However, the fact that the defendant is president of Acme does not require a finding of guilt. Though he need not have personally participated in the situation, he must have had a responsible relationship to the issue. This issue is whether Park, by virtue of his position in the company, had a position of authority and responsibility in the situation out of which these charges arose. The jury convicted Park. The Fourth Circuit reversed the conviction, and they thought there should be some wrongful action, or there should be gross negligence or inattention to charging corporate duties or other acts of commission or omission. The government sought cert. It went to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court, 6-3, reversed the Fourth Circuit and reinstated the conviction. The court noted the purpose of the act is to protect consumers who are largely unable to protect themselves. The only way a corporation can act is through the individuals who operate it. And finally, the court noted that even in 1943, when Dodderwhite, which was actually the first Supreme Court strict liability decision under the act, it said, even in 1943, when Dodderwhite was convicted, strict liability was established under the 1906 Act, and it cited a 1910 appellate court decision. There's two defenses to a criminal strict liability offense. One is objective impossibility, and two is the executive was powerless to act. So I think that's where I will leave it for now. Jerry?
Yes, thank you. And I know, Rick, that you are speaking on your own behalf and not on the government's behalf. I will make a similar disclaimer that I'm speaking on my own behalf and not on behalf of my firm or any of my clients.
Yes, please note this in all the footnotes that you folks put in your briefs about this conversation.
Okay. So I do recognize that FDA has an important regulatory role. I recognize that personal liability can play an important role in law enforcement, both for specific and general deterrence. I don't dispute that the Park case says what Rick says it says, and that there's an objectively impossible defense to the case, although to the theory, although it's not entirely clear what that means. But I'd like to make two points about how PARC can be used in the modern era of FDA-regulated products. And I'm going to talk mostly about drugs, although this could apply to other FDA-regulated products. And first, I think that the PARC doctrine puts too much discretion in the hands of prosecutors. Pharmaceuticals are very heavily regulated, and on FDA's own view of its regulations, really no major company can consistently be in compliance with every aspect of the law all the time. And every violation, even a technical one, that is completely inadvertent, may, on FDA's view, be a violation of the law that can lead to criminal liability. I'm going to talk a little bit about some of the regulations that companies have to comply with. And it's my view that it's no way for a good government to run an industry to have everyone in fear that a prosecutor could bring a criminal action against them, especially given the consequences of having such a conviction. Second, I think that as PARC is now enforced, particularly with regard to pharmaceuticals or how it could be enforced, that it really undercuts the rationale for the Supreme Court's recognition of strict liability offenses. And in particular, the Supreme Court has said that in public welfare cases, strict liability can be appropriate where penalties are relatively small and there's no grave damage to the offender's reputation. But in the pharmaceutical industry, a strict liability conviction can have very significant effects on someone's reputation, and with additional penalties such as exclusion from federal health programs, there can be very significant effects, which are orders of magnitude different from what the Supreme Court was looking at in PARC and Dodderwike. So first, let me talk about the discretion of prosecutors. The Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act prohibits misbranding, adulteration, and many other offenses, and enumerates as prohibited acts those offenses and the causing thereof. And part of the theory under PARC is that someone who's in a position to prevent or correct a problem can be said in some sense to have caused the offense. As Rick pointed out, every offense can be punished as a misdemeanor. If there's intent to defraud or mislead, an offense can be punished as a felony. So let's think about some of the ways that pharmaceuticals are regulated and some of the ways that, on FDA's view, a company could be in violation of the law. Let's start with promotion. Companies might have sales forces of hundreds or thousands of sales representatives. They go out to physicians' offices and promote products. On FDA's view, oral statements by a single sales representative suggesting a use outside of the approved labeled indications would misbrand that company's products and subject the company to criminal liability. Even in those cases where portrayal of evidence might be completely accurate and the company discloses that the product is not approved for that use by FDA. This raises a number of First Amendment issues that could be the subject of a separate podcast, and I won't get into those. But FDA heavily regulates promotion, including in the off-label context that I've talked about, and also if there are misleading statements made in promotional labeling or other promotional materials for the product. And when you have a company that has many products and has subsidiaries all over the world, all over the country, keeping track of these things, of course, can be quite difficult when you have thousands of individuals involved in promotion. Manufacturing is another heavily regulated area. All drugs must be manufactured in compliance with good manufacturing practices. Even if it can be shown that a drug product meets all of its specifications and is appropriately labeled, if the product was not manufactured in compliance with GMPs, the statute says that those products are considered to be adulterated and that FDA can take action without ever showing that there's any threat to health, threat to safety or efficacy, or that the products don't meet specification. Companies may have dozens of manufacturing facilities or scores of manufacturing facilities throughout the world, and the company, in complying with good manufacturing practices, has to do, for example, investigations of every customer complaint. If a company is selling a widely sold consumer product like a pain reliever, it may get thousands of complaints in a year, and it has to investigate every single one. Failure to investigate could be viewed by FDA, to investigate properly, could be viewed by FDA as a violation of the Act. Every deviation from expected manufacturing outcomes has to be investigated. The GMP regulations, FDA reminds industry that they are current good manufacturing practices, and frequently FDA's expectations will become heightened. They will have higher expectations without necessarily clear notice to industry. FDA inspects hundreds or thousands of drug-making facilities every year around the world and issues hundreds or thousands of inspection reports called 483 forms at the conclusion of these investigations. And every single one of these 483s contains observations that the investigator believes constitute a violation of the good manufacturing practices. So you can imagine that there are many companies who are making drugs that FDA puts on notice every year that that the inspector believes that the facility is in violation of the law. Now, FDA understands that there are many facilities that are making perfectly good products that might have observations, and FDA doesn't take regulatory action in the great majority of those cases. But in each of those cases, it's FDA's view that the company is violating the law. Adverse event reporting. Companies are required to report serious and unexpected adverse events about their products. Let's talk about prescription products within 15 days, regardless of where in the world those adverse events occurred. So if a multinational company is selling a product all around the world, when it gets reports of adverse events, it has to analyze them to determine if they're serious and unexpected based on the labeling of the product, and then they need to report those within 15 days. Adverse events can be somebody suffering a bad result. For example, if a patient dies and happens to be taking a drug, it may be reported to the company as an adverse event even when there's no showing that the product caused the problem. There may be multiple confounding factors like other drugs that the patient was taking or other personal health conditions, but those are reported to FDA, and if they're not reported within 15 days, that's considered to be a violation of the Act. So if you imagine a blockbuster drug marketed around the world, especially for a condition where most of the patients are likely to suffer adverse events such as death simply because they're on the drug, not because of the drug, but because the patients are in bad shape, logistically getting these from all over the world and reporting every single one of them within 15 days is not something that companies can do consistently. FDA understands this and doesn't generally take action when companies have a few slip-ups. Companies can put procedures in place, but technically, every failure to report one of those adverse events could be viewed by FDA as a violation of the law. There are many other requirements like these where, on FDA's own view of the regulations, companies simply cannot always be in compliance. They can put in place systems that will try to ensure compliance, but it's really not always possible to ensure continuous compliance at all times, especially when you have a large company. These companies can be very large. You can have, if you look at the organizational chart for a major pharmaceutical company, it could cover a piece of paper several feet square with little boxes the size of postage stamps that cover all the subsidiaries. And the CEO technically is, FDA would say, in a position to correct or prevent violations at any of those subsidiaries. And what this situation does is it creates tremendous discretion in the hands of U.S. attorneys. There are hundreds of them around the country. When you have a product that's sold nationwide, a company could face exposure in many different districts. I don't mean to question the integrity of our U.S. attorneys, our assistant U.S. attorneys, but whenever you have hundreds of people who can exercise discretion in this way, it creates the potential for problems. And sometimes I've heard of situations where FDA inspectors know that companies are afraid of individual liability, and they will specifically ask for, you know, who is personally involved in this or that decision. And sometimes it may be in order to create fear in those in industry. And the purpose of my going through these regulatory requirements is merely to suggest that this kind of essentially unfettered discretion to go after high-level employees, unfettered on FDA's view, is really not the way for good government to regulate an industry. And I recognize that FDA has criteria that it has set forth for when it will pursue a prosecution. And if my good friend Rick Blumberg were in charge of deciding all the cases that would be prosecuted, perhaps everything would turn out fine. But that's not the way things work. There are many hundreds of people around the country who make these decisions, and I think it creates a disadvantageous atmosphere where people feel that they're constantly in fear of this kind of action. So second, I'd like to talk about the magnitude of the penalties. So in the Park and Dodderwhite cases, in Dodderwhite, the defendant had a fine of $500 and 60 days of probation. In the Park case, it was a $250 fine. And these, in current day terms, these are fines in the amount, in the range of thousands of dollars. Now the reality is that if someone has spent a lifetime in the pharmaceutical industry and receives is convicted of a Park offense, without any requirement of showing of knowledge or negligence or any criminal intent at all, that individual can suffer very significant reputational harms, either because companies within the industry may be very hesitant to hire someone who has a conviction, but also because there have been efforts and there may be future efforts to exclude individuals from participation in federal health programs as the result of misdemeanor convictions. There's a case pending in the D.C. Circuit about that very question where individuals were excluded for 12 years from participation in federal health programs, which, given their age, is essentially a lifetime bar from participating, and that is sort of the career death sentence. And so here, where the Supreme Court has upheld strict liability offenses where there are relatively minor penalties and not grave harm to reputation, I think that rationale does not hold given the modern realities of exclusion and the reputational harm that can follow. So again, I recognize that there's some value to individual liability, but I think, given the modern realities, that the Park Doctrine, if carried to its, carried beyond some of the factors that FDA said it might consider, but carried to its logical conclusion and to its extreme, puts too much discretion in the hands of prosecutors and really undercuts the rationale for the Supreme Court's having upheld strict liability offenses.
Okay. I do want to see what's on the mind of our audience, but before we do that, why don't we return to Mr. Blumberg and see if he wants to respond to anything that Jerry Masudi has said.
Yes, I'm tempted to take up the rest of the hour, but I won't. Let me just try and sort of take Jerry's points in order. The point that one of his points was there's too much discretion in the hands of prosecutors, and I think that's an arguable point, but it's also one that the Supreme Court in Dodderwhite was acutely aware of. And it said, in such matters, the good sense of prosecutors, the wise guidance of trial judges, and the ultimate judgment of juries must be trusted. And so even if you have an individual prosecutor who's gone off the reservation and the defense bar can't persuade the U.S. Attorney and Maine Justice and DOJ to turn it around, you do have juries and you do have judges and you do have appellate courts to turn it around. And you have to confess, it's not a perfect system, all right? But it's a trade-off. And Congress also recognized that there's a trade-off. In Dodderwhite, again, the court said, hardship there doubtless may be under a statute which thus penalizes the transaction, though consciousness of wrongdoing be totally wanting. Balancing relative hardships, Congress has preferred to place it upon those who have at least the opportunity of informing themselves of the existence of conditions imposed for the protection of consumers before sharing in illicit commerce, rather than to throw the hazard on the innocent public or wholly helpless. So you have, arguably so-called, quote-unquote, blameless executives, and you have a helpless public. And so how do you balance those two? And the way the courts came down is it ought to be on the executives. They know it's strict liability before they work for these companies. If they don't before they sign up to be hired, Their lawyers tell them as soon as they get there, they're making 7- and 8-figure salaries, many of them, and they need to pay attention to business. And that's what the statute is designed to do. It's to make sure that they exercise this care, and it, frankly, it is to throw a little fear into their hearts so they'll do it. This is more important than the bottom line. And one of Jerry's points was, well, there's so much for them to do, they can't pay attention to everything. And I don't think we're asking they pay any more attention to this than they pay attention to the bottom line and their quarterly reports. Jerry also pointed out rightfully that FDA, we do hundreds of inspections, thousands, and, you know, issue thousands of 483s. And yet at the end of the day, we probably don't bring more than, at most, 2 park cases a year. So I don't think anybody can accuse us of actual abuse, although, you know, it's certainly arguable that the potential is there. But what you have to realize is this. FDA regulates, according to some, like 25% of every consumer dollar spent in the United States. We're not counting foreign now, which also has to go into the mix. There are hundreds of thousands of facilities under FDA's jurisdiction and probably millions of products. We have 2,000 inspectors. Some companies have sales forces that big. We can't be everywhere. So how does Congress assure or put some pressure on the corporate world to take care of business and protect the public? And the answer is a doctrine like Park, which tells them they act at their peril if they don't pay attention to what their business, to their obligation to the public. Perhaps an extreme example, but one that I'll put in there is that, you know, the executives can't pay attention to everything. They have adverse drug reaction issues. They have general manufacturing practice, good manufacturing practice, and they have off-label. It's clear to me that in off-label, at least, no responsible pharma executive can now pretend that he wasn't aware that this is a potential problem in his company. And they know exactly where to look for the creators of the problem. It's the marketing department. And there are many things that they could do to make sure that it doesn't happen. And yet it still happens, despite the fact that the government has collected some $13 or $15 billion for off-label marketing, it still occurs. That tells me that corporate executives are not taking this responsibly. They're not taking their obligations responsibly. In terms of the, I think Jerry's second point was, and I'll just wrap this up quickly, was the penalties now are potentially so much greater that sort of undercuts the rationale for Park, because before the penalties were relatively light. Well, it's always been the case under the Act, I think at least since 1962, that a second offense is a felony. FDA has only used that once, to my knowledge, but there was always a potential for a pretty severe penalty. In the one case where that I'm aware of where there has been exclusions, the case that Jerry referred to on appeal in the D.C. Circuit, that was widespread conduct by a lot of people in the company for a long time, and the corporate executives either knew about it and failed to prevent it, or they just had willful blindness and didn't want to know about it. So given the harm that was caused in that case and the longevity and the seriousness of the conduct, frankly, it doesn't bother me too much that they would be excluded. Why would anybody want people like that responsible for mass marketing drugs across the country? And they had the opportunity to prevent it, and they didn't. So I don't think the penalty is that severe, period.
This is Jerry. May I respond?
Yes, go right ahead. Go ahead. Just take a minute or two.
So a couple of things. First, Rick said that that executives act at their peril if they don't pay attention to their business. But the problem with the Park Doctrine is that they act at their peril even if they do pay attention to their business, and even if they do put in place very significant methods for preventing violations. It's not just if they don't pay attention to their business, it's even if they do. Second, Rick pointed out that executives know that these issues are potential problems, and I wouldn't deny that. The executives that I've dealt with do know about the legal requirements, and they know that there are potential problems. The issue is less with that than with controlling very large organizations where there are so many violations that one can step in any day of the week on FDA's view. And it's not that they don't recognize that it's a potential problem, but that in some cases it's just maybe this gets into the impossibility defense, but again, I don't think FDA's view, when it issues these thousands of 483s and then picks one or two in its discretion, or when the U.S. attorneys pick one or two in their discretion, it's not that the executives don't know that it's a potential problem. And then finally, with regard to the exclusion case, I think that in the plea documents there was no evidence of any knowledge of the problems that were at issue in the Friedman case. I don't think there was anything suggesting that the individuals did participate or have knowledge of the violations.
Just a quick rejoinder. I think it really comes down to, I think, when you boil down Jerry's and my differences, you sort of have two competing considerations that are in conflict. Putting people at peril, executives at peril who are quote-unquote innocent or quote-unquote practically helpless, versus leaving the public at the risk of people who we can't always investigate and can't always prove violations. And what the court has said, the Congress has tipped the balance in favor of placing that peril upon the executives. It's a policy judgment. It's a political judgment. I don't know what you want to call it, but that's where we are.
Okay. Well, thank you for those opening remarks and discussion. I do want to see where our audience is on these issues. So I'm now going to open the floor to the audience questions. Let's go to the first question.
John Rowland, Constitution.org. From all this, one can certainly understand why drugs are so expensive, why the ads for them consist mainly of a bunch of disclaimers, and why perhaps people who are most able to estimate risk don't go into the field of managing these operations, leaving the field perhaps to less qualified people. So, but I'd like to examine the constitutionality of some of these issues. If you will indulge me and go back to 1787 and the original meanings of things like regulate and crime, the original meaning of regulate did not include criminal penalties, only civil penalties. And the original meaning of crime was that if there was no mens rea, it was not a crime. So strict liability would be considered unconstitutional by originalist standards.
Either of you want to respond to that?
I'm not much of a historian to respond to it. Trying to go back to figure out what the framers thought has always been a problem for me. I'd like to know what the framers think about the internet and airplanes and things like that. So we are what we are.
Mr. McKee.
Yeah, I mean, the Supreme Court has upheld strict liability offenses in some contexts. I think in this context, it raises real questions.
Okay.
But I will say there's an old Supreme Court case. It's either Nash v. United States or United States v. Nash, where somebody raised a due process argument that the crime wasn't sufficiently defined, and it put people at peril for acting criminal exposure. And I think it was Justice Frankfurter or Cardozo, I'm not sure who, said something like, the law is full of instances where the line is not bright and people approach it at their peril, including at the peril of their life.
Okay. Go to the next audience question.
Hi, this is Chris from the Libertarian Party, and I would so much like to abolish the FDA. These very sort of ability of the FDA to go after people for offenses that are unclear is exactly what makes them a terrorist organization. The ability to go after a cherry distributor because he links to a government site that claims that cherries are good for you, and thereby makes himself make the cherry manufacturer turns himself into a drug supplier. The FDA is guilty of so much overreaching that really the best cure for it is to abolish it completely. And either of you can comment on.
Sure. I don't agree with characterizing FDA as in the same sentence as terrorist, and I don't advocate for abolition. I do think that there are some very significant areas where it could be meaningfully reformed to encourage innovation and to better serve the public interest.
Mr. Blumberg, do you want to respond?
I don't think whatever I said, no matter how brilliant, would change the commenter's view, so no.
Okay, let me ask a follow-up question. I mean, is there agreement between the two of you or disagreement over the vagueness of these provisions, or is it all about provisions that might be fairly well defined, but yet the issue is strict liability versus some other higher form of mens rea?
Jerry, you want to go first?
Sure. I think in many areas the standards are not entirely clear, and that that U.S. attorneys' offices sometimes take things further than certainly my understanding of what the law permits, especially in the promotional context where you have not only what the regulations say, but the overlay of the First Amendment, which I think some of FDA's regulations and what it does in the promotional context do infringe on First Amendment rights. And those are not clearly defined. I think that we could get better definition in some of the promotional areas in the Coronia case and in other cases that follow. And in the manufacturing context, I think that there are clearly some ambiguous requirements, especially when one considers current good manufacturing practice and how FDA frequently is tightening those requirements.
Mr. Blumberg.
I will just say, you know, with so many laws and so many applications and so many myriad factual situations in which they can arise, there's going to be some vagueness. And I think the answer to that is, to the extent that a defendant believes that FDA is applying the law in an improper manner or the law itself is vague, they have a separate challenge, independent of the Park Doctrine, on vagueness grounds.
Are they getting any traction in courts on those claims they're being brought?
Vagueness grounds?
Yeah.
I can't think of the last time we lost one. There's a number of First Amendment cases flying around with mixed results. But
does that have to do with?
I just don't think any of this really sort of directly implicates the Park Doctrine.
Right. Very good. Okay, we've got a couple more questioners lined up. Let's go to the next caller.
This is Richard Samp with the Washington Legal Foundation. I have a question for Rick Blumberg. You said that there are many, many pharmaceutical executives who are derelict in their duty and aren't doing enough to supervise their employees, yet only several times per year at most do you seek exclusion of executives, and that therefore you're only going after the worst of the worst. My problem with that, of course, is that the Park Doctrine is a no-fault law. It requires no mens rea. Would you at FDA support a change in the law so that when you do go after these worst of the worst, you at least have to demonstrate that the executives at issue were negligent? Because once you did that, then there wouldn't be the problem that people were being excluded from the industry on a no-fault basis.
Well, the answer is I wouldn't know. But nobody's going to listen to me, whatever my views are on that issue. That's way above my pay grade. And I think in application, frankly, many prosecutors probably apply a negligence standard or a knowing standard de facto, even though they're not required to.
But the jury is not given the option of saying that you should acquit if you find the person not negligent. Isn't that the point of a no-fault law?
Yes. Well, I mean, there's always the recourse to Congress. The people who want to abolish the FDA and don't like the law, they're going to try and amend it to get rid of it. And I think, frankly, there is a bill right up there right now that I understand is getting no traction. There's been past attempts as well to amend the Food and Drug Act to get rid of the Park Doctrine. If anything, I think FDA can be criticized for not applying the Park Doctrine nearly enough, not for overusing it.
Mr. Masoudi, you want to weigh in on this point?
I would not encourage FDA to use it more according to its own terms as a strict liability offense, and I would support having a negligence standard rather than a strict liability standard.
Okay. Looks like we have one more caller question.
Yes, this is Holly Pearson, and I'm with a law firm in Atlanta, and speak on these issues in the Park Doctrine and handle that with clients a lot. So I guess I am more on the private side now, although I used to prosecute these cases, so I always joke that I used to convict the guilty and now I defend the wrongly accused. So I see both of your points on the issue, but here is what I think at the heart of the Park Doctrine debate is right now, at least in the circles in which we're running. And that is, you know, we know what happened in the honest services area where the government, and at least in ultimately the Supreme Court's view, started overreaching, over-enforcing, and eventually got its hand smacked. And the doctrine was removed from its arsenal of tools in a lot of areas that it had previously been using it. I think there's a lot of speculation, both inside and outside the government, DOJ, FDA, and on the private defense side, that if DOJ, as it has promised to do, increases its activity in the Park Doctrine arena and starts to more aggressively use individual liability in its prosecution of these cases, then that will ultimately be challenged. You know, the companies are not going to challenge it, but if you start taking away people's individual liberty, more likely to draw a challenge eventually will end up before the Roberts Court. And I think there are a lot of constitutional scholars that believe that if that happens, that it would not, the Park Doctrine would not survive a review by the Roberts Court. I'm interested in your views on that, and the rationale that I've heard on that is, you know, that the Park Doctrine, whatever Congress struck in its balance in this statute, the Supreme Court had a very hard time with it, and that the only reason that they ended up where they ended up in Park was because they relied extraordinarily heavily not on the policy considerations that we've talked about, but on the lightness of the penalty, that was really the linchpin. And because the penalties are so much more severe and a lot of the penalties that are now available were not even in existence at the time of Park, that if that happens and it goes to the Roberts Court, that Park won't survive. So I guess I'm interested in your thoughts on that.
Well, Jerry.
I think certainly in the First Amendment context, when you're talking about promotional issues, that there's real risk to the agency in pressing these kinds of cases. So you have the Park issue and then also the First Amendment issues, and I think there is a risk that these kinds of authorities could be clipped back.
I haven't read the Park briefs in a long time or the Dodderwhite briefs, but where in these decisions in the Supreme Court's analysis does it place a lot of weight on the lightness of the penalty?
In the actual Park decision is the one I have specifically in mind. It's specifically in deciding that it will allow a strict liability, criminal liability. It specifically notes that one of the significant factors that it is relying on is the lightness of the penalty, the fact that they will not face severe sanction. And there is some discussion, although I don't think it's clearly in the holding of Park, but there's also some discussion in the decision about you know, the perils that attenuate with strict liability criminal responsibility, and that they struggled with that. I mean, I don't have the language right in front of me, but I think it's pretty well known that that's one of the linchpins of Park.
All right. I mean, to me, the court touched on it, but I don't see any great wrestling and analysis about it.
So do you think then that Park would survive the Roberts Court analysis, even given the current penalty structures that are available?
Yeah, I mean, don't hold me to this. I haven't given a whole lot of thought to it, but it seems to me the Park Doctrine as a doctrine and whether it works or not is a separate issue, for example, on how CMS decides whether or not to exclude on applying the Park Doctrine. I'm not sure those two necessarily go hand in hand, and one could attack the severity or the alleged severity of the exclusion penalty without ever reaching reaching the liability of the Park Doctrine.
Mr. Masuda, you want to weigh in here?
Yeah, and I think that the timing of it, given that ordinarily the conviction and any sentence of imprisonment or a fine would come first and exclusion would come later, some of those penalties may not appear right at the time of conviction and be part of that consideration. But I think just some of the reputational harms that are attendant with any conviction in this industry might be factored into that.
You know, that gets back to the basic point, it seems to me. on one side of the scale, you put the corporate people's reputational harm, and on the other side, you put whatever value you place that the existence of the doctrine gives to the public health. And you can't argue on the one hand that reputation, which is always in play, is so severe, and the park struggled with it. I mean, but it went ahead and did it anyhow. I mean, it feels like a eat my cake and have it too argument on the reputation part of it.
We have another question, so let's go to that.
John Rowling, Constitution.org. If some of these cases go to a jury, it would seem that we're seeing a need to return to the original standard of due process set forth in Stettinius v. U.S., that all issues of law, including the constitutional issues, be argued to the jury before they retire to the jury room, and that the argument not be confined to judges' chambers. So what do you think about returning to that standard of due process, which would apply to all criminal cases or cases in which the government is a party?
That's a much larger question. I don't think the Supreme Court would support that all these legal questions be given to the jury.
Who would need the Supreme Court?
Right.
Since we have a couple minutes left, let me give each of you a minute or so to express any final thoughts you might have. Let's begin, as we did in our opening remarks, with Mr. Blumberg.
Nothing comes to mind right away, but maybe if Jerry says something, he'll provoke me.
Well, I think I've exhausted all of my comments as well.
Okay. Well, terrific. Well, let me
I mean, I think
you.
At the end of the day, I guess I'll say this. Maybe I've said the same thing three times. At the end of the day, it seems to me, it really how you feel about Park depends upon how much you weigh the risk and the jeopardy that executives place themselves in by coming into these industries and the consequences they face and the alleged harshness of those consequences. Put that on one side of the scale versus the benefit that you think that the public accrues to the public by having corporate executives acting much more carefully to prevent these harms.
And I guess my view is that the sheer balancing of the public policy interests is not the only consideration. We do have the due process clause, and that there are individual liberty interests, individual interests that that can trump certain balancing that Congress chooses to engage in. And that, I think, is the real question.
Very good. Well, we'll let that be the final word. On behalf of the Federalist Society, I do want to thank Mr. Masoudi and Mr. Blumberg for joining us today. Thanks also to our audience, of course. Thank you very much. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.